Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Real Jam Radio. I am Daniel, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. This is a rare off-season tears pot with Matt Moore of the Action Network of Locked On NBA and Locked On Nuggets, and we had a lot of fun with it, came together pretty quickly, and I'm absolutely thrilled with the product. It is brought to you by FanDuel. Go to FanDuel.com/Boston, and you can get up to $200 in bonus bets, win or lose, which is awesome. But Matt and I, as usual, we tier the entire NBA. I will let him explain the criteria. You will see it soon enough. And this is, I believe, the longest tiers episode we've ever done. It's well over an hour 20, might even be an hour and a half, depending on how I edit it. But that is enough for now. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Really love doing this. I always look forward to it.
Yeah, and this one was on short notice, but you had a great prompt. I'm so thrilled that we're able to make it happen. I'll let you explain it.
Yeah, so we're going to keep this one simple. We're just going to do the, as far as this one goes, we're just going to do overall team strength in tiers today. Just looking at the offseason, and it's really funny to me when I went through and I looked at this this format when I did the exercise about how different it is in the preseason and off season rather than in the regular season, because my top is so much heavier than I know it will be in season. I know that, like, I have a majority of teams in the top three tiers, and then I know that by mid season I will be very much distributed more towards the middle, because you're never quite as good as kind of the idea of what these teams should or could be in season knows.
Yeah. Along those lines, we'll get to this tier later on, but like, I have one where I call it like expected top six. And there are, I believe, like eight teams in each conference in, like, included in that tier and above. But the idea is that inevitably some teams will fall out either due to quality, but more likely due to injury. And so, like, I first I'm like, oh, this is stupid. And then I went, no, that actually seems about right. And I'll leave it to you in terms of the top. There, you said your tiers are a little bit more thickly bunched. Mine get thicker, but aren't thick at the beginning.
I would concur with that, because I actually, in the S tier, I only have one. There's only one team that I have at the top. And that's not your defending champion Denver Nuggets. It is, in fact, the Boston Celtics.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So is this a belief in the Porzingis fit?
It's a belief in the Porzingis fit. It's based off of a lot of, if you get past the idea of what Porzingis has been over the last 4 years, and you look more recently, now maybe KP had an outlier season in a contract year and slides. That's entirely possible. Maybe, you know, the injury concerns, I think, are very serious with Porzingis. The combination of Porzingis' health, Robert Williams' health, and Al Horford's age with the loss of Grant Williams makes that front court thinner. It makes it to where they're a little bit more vulnerable to what I've started referring to crib a term from NFL, of cluster injuries. Mm-hmm. If you have, you might have a section of the season, like 2-3 weeks, where it's like, man, they just don't have a front court right now. Like, they just don't have one. And that's possible. But if we look at what Porzingis provides with the ability to have, okay, what's some bread and butter we can run when the offense gets rough? Let's just run pick and roll with Tatum and KP, and we'll be able to create a leverage out of that, whether it's with Tatum or with Porzingis. And that will make things easier for everyone else. It doesn't necessarily solve all of their problems with organization and staying focused the way that they need to with how that they play. But it does provide them with some stuff that's not necessarily as volatile as their offense can sometimes be in these late game situations, which, you know, is a reason for downgrade. Love the shot blocking. You know, him and Robert Williams and double big lineups is going to be terrifying. And then that's the overall team strength. Like, just based off of how I kind of approach my offseason build, which is I've got a power rating that I use for spreads, which is how many points should you be favored by against a team on neutral court? And then you extrapolate that to by a basic measure to establish how many wins they should have. The Celtics are kind of by themselves. They were a level before I factored in the gain of Kristaps Porzingis and the loss of Marcus Smart. I initially gave them a good, but not like a huge bump because I have so much respect for Marcus Smart. And then upon further reflection, I was just like, I don't want to overweight last season because I think we do that too much where we just react to last season and act like that's who guys are instead of taking 3 or 4 year samples of guys' careers when they're veterans. But at the same time, KP was undeniably excellent last year and impactful. And Marcus Smart was a little bit less than he has been. And so year over year, taking last year's rating, I wound up then rebumping them up a little bit. And so I have them quite firmly as the best team in the NBA. That doesn't mean that they're going to win the title. It doesn't mean that I don't think that there's issues all over. But as kind of an indicator of where I've got them in terms of team strength, I have them at 57 wins for this upcoming season. That is by far, they've got a 3-win gap over the number two team.
I respect that argument. And I had a funny moment when I was going through this when you were talking, because I have them in tier one. I just have them with some other teams. And I was like, oh, you know, with the moves and departure of Grant Williams, like the Celtics, they only have 7 guys that I really trust in a playoff rotation for them right now. And inevitably, players will play better, will be like, oh, player X, you know, whether that's Pritchard or they'll sign somebody on the buyout market or something to happen. But when you compare them to some of the other teams, like 7's actually kind of a lot. Like, that's just the way this works out. Talent is a little bit more distributed, and that might be in some ways one of the intended effects of the new CBA, is the idea that like Boston didn't find it tenable to retain Grant Williams and everything else. And so I'm largely on board with you. The one note that I'll add, which is going to be so fascinating for this team, is I think this is a harder coaching job now. The roster is a little less balanced. Balance can be a good thing and it can be a bad thing, but you brought up the injuries in the front court, but it's also a thinner backcourt now. I have not been the biggest Marcus Smart partisan over the years, but he does raise the team's floor. And like, so now if Derek White's having an off game, if Brogdon's dealing with an injury, like they don't have as many places to go, even if the Celtics need their guards to do less than almost any other team in the NBA. You could make an argument that the only team that needs them to do less is the Denver Nuggets, but that's a little bit different. And so that's something I consider. But I ended up with Boston, and I had 3 teams, and they're loosely described, but what I said on this one is their title top end, so meaning they have that championship group, and their regular season deep, so meaning like, and there's a specific, I'm excluding a specific team from that probably, where it's like, I think that they have a fundamentally different four. Like for Boston, I could see things not working, but it would surprise me if they won fewer than 50 games. And the other teams that broadly fit that description, one is the reigning defending champion Denver Nuggets, and the other is the Milwaukee Bucks. And the Bucks are the most tenuous of these three to me. I think that not only is it the regular season deep part of it that makes me a little queasy. I mean, they have these phenomenal top end players that you can put other guys around them, but it does seem like the Bucks are perpetually thinning out other than the best guys. But it's also, you know, they lost Mike Budenholzer, who's one hell of a head coach, and I don't know. I think that their floor is going to be roughly the same because their best guys are this good. But there's a part of me that's like, you idiot, they're not as reliable as these other two.
I will be quite honest. I had to very much scrap and claw to put them in my tier two.
Ooh, okay.
And a lot of that is I put them there because of the reasons that people would say you have to have them in there, which is they have Giannis. The minutes and win record with Giannis, Drew, Chris, and Brooke are incredible. Like, they win a metric ton of games. They kill teams. The depth, as you kind of talked about, is not there. It continues to kind of degrade. Like, Javon Carter does not matter in a vacuum. Javon Carter matters when it's they did not replace him with anything notable. And I don't, you know, Joe Ingles doesn't matter on his own. It matters when you don't replace him with anything necessarily all that notable. And so I have a hard time kind of getting around what we saw last year, because there was a big reason why I wasn't betting and was actively betting against Milwaukee in the various markets that we track. And some of this is just that, you know, my projected power rating had them significantly lower, and they kept winning games because sometimes teams do that and they have the capacity to do that. But when we really start to, you talked about like the top seven, when we get past that top five, and really when we get past the top four, it just, it's like Bobby's probably their fifth best player overall, because I like him more than Grayson or Pat Connaughton. And you're just like, ooh, I don't know if Bobby should be fifth best. And then it's like Pat Connaughton, should he be this, you know, should Grayson Allen be their fifth best or sixth best player? I mean, that.
The weirdest thing about the Bucks, how many players do they have on this team that are legitimately good at dribbling? Yeah. It's not many. It's kind of weird with them. And like idea of just like get a set it and forget it backup point guard who costs like $4 million a year. Like I would feel so much more comfortable in their regular season four if they had a guy like that or had any of the last couple of years.
Marjan was not impressive in summer league. Maybe he pops. Maybe Andre Jackson pops. Like there's upside potential here for events that we can't really project, but being like pretty stable in our projections, it just gets really tough, especially I think when we kind of look at the numbers. And honestly, this is my experience watching them play. It wasn't just a numbers approach. They just simply weren't as good as that win total. Right. They were not a number one seed team last year. And it wasn't surprising to me. I put out my first round predictions on Twitter, and I'm not just victory lapping here, but like I said Bucks and seven over the Heat, and everyone thought I was crazy. Like, I mean, it was like, you're absolutely out of your mind. What would makes you think that this is even going to be close? And I was like, Miami is always going to be a pain, and the Bucks are not as good as they look. And, you know, the injury is probably what decided that series. But the reason that they weren't able to sustain an injury even to their best player and get that to six or seven games is because of their overall team strength. And so I look at that and I go, so wait, we got the same team with less depth with another year on the old guys.
Yes.
They are a very old team now with, you know, Giannis already sitting out FIBA with his injury concerns. And then you have this downgrade in coach, where they get, I think, is one of the most fascinating things when we talk about like perception versus reality, because everyone was like, Mike Budenholzer is not good enough. He's too inflexible. And I'm like, all of these things are postseason issues. Mike Budenholzer annihilates the NBA regular season. He did it in Atlanta. He did it every single season with the Milwaukee Bucks. And betting on that has been extremely profitable. So from the lens that I look at, dropping from Mike Budenholzer to almost any other coach from a regular season perspective is a massive drop, let alone going to an unproven coach in his first year. So
you convinced me. I moved them down. They're in tier two for me now.
Yeah, I just can't get there with them being. And it's like, yeah, but Giannis, and that might be enough. That really might honestly be enough because of how dominant he is. And Brooke was amazing last year, got paid. Chris was good when he was healthy, got paid. Maybe he plays through a little bit more stuff because he doesn't have to worry about getting the contract. Like those kind of things can shift things.
And like maybe Griffin does a great job, but this is about confidence and certainty. And we can't be certain of anyone who's never been an NBA coach.
It's interesting that your top tier is bigger, but you kind of have these teams that are there. And then like, how much would you say is the gap between your tier one and your tier two?
Moderate, not super, not high for sure. And then, but I wouldn't say it's like razor thin.
Right.
But what's your tier two?
So I've got the Denver Nuggets, would be in tier one if not for the loss of their veteran depth and my questions about essentially their motivation, and also that their numbers weren't quite as good last year as they kind of looked from a regular season perspective. You could explain a lot of that with like the first 2 months of the season and the last month of the season. And that's fair. That's also kind of who they are. Like I'm not expecting this team to come out. There's a possible, I've been, you know, talking about this a lot on Locked On Nuggets, which I host, which is there's a possibility that I'm completely wrong and Denver comes out motivated, because sometimes you win that championship and you understand who you are and you thrive and you make a run the next year that's even better. Like, we've seen that.
The 14-15 Warriors.
Mm-hmm. A good example.
Sorry, 15-16.
Yeah, 15-16. Another good example of that, honestly, in terms of more recent, is, like, I think that the 2022 Bucks were...
Oh, yeah.
...were actually way better than the 21 Bucks. They just happened to run into the Chris Middleton injury versus Boston. So you've got, like, this. That's impossible that the Nuggets come out next year and just... They are able to casually and very easily dominate the regular season because of the strength of their top five. But boy, is that depth gone. Any injury after a long, long playoff run with Jamal Murray playing in FIBA and Nikola Jokic, there's a lot of like suggestion he will play. We don't know yet. Those two questions are going to lead into how much those guys are available. That all factors in when you lose the kind of depth that they did. So Denver's in that tier. This is a thick tier. It's got Denver, Milwaukee, Phoenix, Miami, assuming the Damian Lillard trade, the Memphis Grizzlies, the Cleveland Cavaliers, and the Philadelphia 76ers if they get quality return on James Harden. I basically put the Sixers in two different spots here. They're either in tier two or tier three, depending on what the Harden trade yields.
That is very close to mine. I have Miami in their own tier three just by themselves on the idea that they'll either be a tier higher if they get Lillard and a tier lower if they do not. I actually think, I want to talk about Miami briefly, their departures, if we just take this team as they sit right now, I think they're underappreciated.
Not, I agree.
Gabe Vincent and Max Strus are not world beaters, but they are players who, and they had rough regular seasons last year. It's a part of why the Heat ended up struggling like they did in the regular season. But they're capable, they can fill these roles, and like you brought up with Denver, they didn't really replace them. And Kevin Love can fill more of a role in the regular season because he got there late during the season. And hopefully they can, you know, Tyler Hero, but he got injured in the playoffs. Like he had some regular season stuff too. They have like Josh Richardson and a few other guys, but there's a part of me that just lingers and goes, you thought the same thing 2 years ago and then those guys were good. And then that ended up blowing through their over and everything like that. But I believe in Miami significantly more as a postseason team than a regular season team, even though Spo is one hell of a coach. So maybe I should just believe.
You know, I think I have some difficulties here, too, based off of if we kind of look at it from a salary perspective. Right. So Jimmy's at 45. What's Dame at for per year next season? Do you have any idea? Guesstimate it.
I could do better than that. 45.6.
Okay, so Jimmy and Dame are 45, so that's 90. And this is like what happens when you go top heavy is you're gonna get thinner as it goes along, and I understand that. Bam's at 32, and that's a great top three, and that's an elite top three, and I love the fit of Dame specifically with Bam Adebayo. I think that's such a great combination. But Kyle Lowry and Tyler Hero will be gone in the trade. Like, we know that. That's their next two guys. Duncan Robinson's a maybe, but maybe he's around. And so now you're at like even if they keep Duncan, now you're at the fifth highest paid guy is Caleb Martin. If he stays in the deal at 6.8, and then the drop for sixth best is Kevin Love at 3.8. And this is a lot of what we're going to see with the new CBA, certainly. But it's also, I think a lot of this is, can Haywood Highsmith make the kind of jump that they've seen from other undrafted players that they've seen have such success? Can Orlando Robinson capitalize on a great summer league and do the same kind of thing? Can Jaime be an impact rookie right away the way that Tyler Hero was for the Heat? I'll also say that there's a lot of this built in the conversation and the discussion and how they're perceived of, well, they did it before. Like, look what they did with these undrafted guys, so they can just do that again. I've started to refer to this as the Ujiri fallacy, mm-hmm. which is Toronto. It was like, look at their development plan. Look at all these guys that they put in there. Like, they developed Pascal, and they developed OG, and they developed Fred VanVleet, and they and then it's like, okay, but look in 4 years later, and look who's around.
It's still those guys.
how's Malachi Flynn doing? How's Elano Banton doing? Like, that they don't have... It's hard if you do not have premium assets to keep hitting even like doubles with pitches that are tough to hit. And so there is kind of this, I think, diminishing returns aspect that winds up happening here, where it does impact it. Plus, you know, their success in the regular season 2 years ago, and that 2022 team was really good compared to this year. Like, that was a much better team, but it was built on their defense. And Spo can certainly pull enough tricks. But one thing I will also note that we've kind of started to see, there's two things that happened this season I'm interested to see if they carry forward. One was that offenses mattered slightly more than defenses. Top 10 offenses went over their win rate at a higher rate than top 10 defenses, which is the first time we've seen that in 10 years. The second thing that kind of happened was that all of the tricks that defined really 2016, maybe 17 through 2022, which is, can you play zone and can you switch? Congratulations, you have a top five defense. Those things started to really fall off. Switch defenses were not nearly as effective last season as they have been because offenses have largely adjusted and they've gotten better and are performing better. So I wonder about a team that's primary kind of concept is, well, we're going to have an elite defense and we're going to have Dame to boost up the offense with less defensive personnel and a little bit worse in terms of supporting offensive units. What does that look like on a unit basis? The overall talent is obviously superb, but what does it look like? So I have some questions, but then ultimately I put them here because this tier is entirely made up of teams that I'm like, if you told me, if you came back in time and said, hey, these teams win the 2024 NBA championship, and you told me the Miami Heat did, I'd be like, all right, that tracks. They had Jimmy and they had Bam and they had Dame.
One team that's in this tier that I want to just mention, I think it gets lost in the shuffle now considering how rough their playoff exit was. The Cleveland Cavaliers finished second in Cleaning the Glass net rating last year, plus 5.8. And there are reasons to believe that their playoff struggles are real and that it's going to be hard for them to fix everything that ails them and, you know, how all this stuff is going to fit. They are a monstrous regular season team and should continue to be so. And they're deep. They have more bites at the apple in terms of solving the fifth starter, fifth closer problem, with Max Strus is to me the most interesting of those guys. I don't think he's the only one. Maybe Dean Wade will actually not suffer a debilitating injury and actually be able to shoot this year. And also just they have these salaries that aren't particularly burdensome for guys like LeVert. Maybe they could do something there. And Mike Okoro is going to be a year older. He could be a better fit there. And so for Cleveland, this is going to be, to me, a put up or shut up year for them, because after this season, Donovan Mitchell is going to be 1 year away from a player option. So his player option is 25-26, but that is around the time where all of these things kind of start to shake themselves out, for better or for worse. I hope the great players stay where they are if they're in a good situation. But they should be, I think they're going to be a really good regular season team.
If they were coached by what I would consider to be an average level or replacement level coach for playoff purposes, I think JB's done an amazing job in the regular season. But if they had an average or replacement level playoff coach, I would bet this team to win the title because their numbers are absolutely ridiculous in the market. I can't because of that factor. I just can't get there. It's really important to note, when I talk about this, and I beat the dead horse so much on Twitter last year about the rotations and not playing Okoro, it's important to note that it doesn't mean that I think that New York is a bad team, because they are the best team in my third tier. I think New York could very easily be in the second tier. I just can't be like, oh, I can see them winning the championship. I can't get there. And a lot of that is reflective of they were fourth in offense and 19th in defense last year versus the Cavs, and schedule adjusted over at Dunks and Threes, were eighth in offense, first in defense. So we're talking about the best defense in the league with a top 10 offense. That's the resume of a championship contender. And as you mentioned, you know, second best net rating schedule adjusted in the league last season. Donovan Mitchell's numbers do not reflect how good he is. Like, the consideration of him is not as good as when you kind of dive into the kind of deeper level analysis. And he missed a big chunk of time in a year where he was trying to get used to a new team, and Garland missed time. They had guys in and out of the lineup all year. When that starting group is together, it's really good. And their moves to add Niang and Strus, even though Strus was an overpay, directly addressed the problem of, we need that fifth guy in the corner to maintain spacing so you can't as aggressively attack our ball handlers. That changes dramatically. The reality is that JB got outcoached by Tom Thibodeau, and anybody in the betting markets will tell you that Tibbs is one of the worst coaches in terms of performance against the market in the NBA playoffs. He is universally terrible and has been since that first run with the Bulls. So it's tough for me when I'm like, this guy got outcoached outcoached by a coach I regularly enjoy betting against. I think that Tibbs is still really good and that the Knicks were a really good team last year, but it was more that Cleveland was capable of so much more and accomplished so little, and the dropout was so bad. There continues to be the conversations about Jared Allen. I do wonder how that kind of plays out, because I don't think that they should move on. I don't think that Evan Mobley is ready for full-time five yet. I do think that they actually benefit from that size advantage. There's all these ways that this could go sideways, and as you mentioned, the Donovan Mitchell situation will continue to kind of percolate no matter what. But if we're entering into the season, like, I put them here tentatively, because it's like, okay, look, the matchup was bad. They got solved by New York. Would better teams probably have solved them too? Yeah, maybe JB learns from that and he's a better coach next season. First playoff run, I'm willing to give him an opportunity to kind of go further, improve, and get them past, especially when he has better roster options now after free agency. So I put the Cavs in that tier too.
I'm happy you brought up the better roster options. I think part of the story of the Cavs in the playoffs is, A, they ran up against a team that had strengths in the areas. Like, so Cleveland, they took Cleveland's first punch and Cleveland didn't have a counterpunch. Some of that goes on Bickerstaff. Some of that goes on just the nature of their roster. Like, they have this weird combination of players and they don't really have other ways that they've done it. But I agree with you that they could theoretically figure those out either just over the course of time or, you know, maybe eventually with a different coach. I thought Bickerstaff, like you, did a good job in the regular season. Did you have the Lakers in this year? I thought I heard you mention them, because I do as well.
I did not.
Oh, okay. I have them here.
I do not. I have them in tier three pretty solidly. I do have, I'll mention the Memphis Grizzlies really quickly.
Sure.
I think there's a good reason to buy in on this Grizzlies team. I think that I've been resistant to them because of their problems in half court. They started to really kind of recognize those problems, and that's one of the reasons they went out and got Luke Kennard. It was very clear that they were like, guys, we got to figure out how to score in these game by game situations. And the Lakers exit had as much to do with the injuries to Steven Adams and Brandon Clark. You talk about cluster injury. When your cluster injury results in Xavier Tillman having to start, you're in a real bind. And
then when Kennard gets hurt on top of that, then you don't have the variability in your offense.
Right. And Tillman, quite honestly, played pretty well in that series, but that's like never the guy that I would have wanted in that series versus the Lakers. It was a bad matchup. Anthony Davis played great. Like, all credit to them. Rui Hachimura was excellent. All credit to them. Memphis has a lot of opportunity, I think, to self-reflect and improve on the things that they need to now. I'm expecting a huge bump from Desmond Bane this year. I cannot buy any more Desmond Bane stock. Jaren showed me enough last year in growing his offense and being somebody you can give the ball to and excel with that I'm interested in buying in on them as well. Am I worried about where Jaw's head's at? Of course. Of course I'm worried about where Jaw's head's at. At the same time, from an overall team perspective and like without knowing the timeline of when those issues with Jaw could pop up again, to me it's worth putting them in this tier. This is an elite defense with the capacity of athletes and talent to make real strides offensively. And if they put those things together, this is going to be a juggernaut again.
A strange element of the Grizzlies roster is that, like, now with Marcus Smart, they have a top four closers, however you want to define it, in Ja, Smart, Bane, and Jaren Jackson Jr. that not only do I believe in individually, but I believe in them together. Like, I think they can fit together. And one of the beautiful things about that is you could do a lot of fifths with that. And Memphis actually has more options for that fifth guy than most teams do, whether you're talking about, you know, going big with Adams, whose screening is very underappreciated for the Grizz. But also, as you mentioned, like Kennard, or you could go with Zaire Williams if things work out, or Santi Aldama, and they're like, weirdly, they still have their full mid-level, which they're not going to use, probably because there isn't anyone left to use it on. They also have a big trade exception of like $8 million from the Dylan Brooks deal. I don't know who they would get with that either. But it's the challenge with Memphis is, well, okay, but who is it going to actually be? Like, if Zaire Williams hadn't had this season from hell, I would be even more confident on the Grizzlies. The other part of it is we know John Morant's going to miss the start of the season, and losing Tyus Jones made it so that they're, you know, Marcus Smart is a plenty good player. They have the talent to withstand this injury, but not an injury, notably. So I do believe in the Grizzlies. I had them at the top of my tier three and said could be higher. So I'm listening to your arguments. Also, Taylor Jenkins, a very good regular season coach. So yeah.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
But I'll go briefly into the Lakers idea of it. And part of it is this concept of once they made their roster actually make sense, they were a pretty good team when they were remotely healthy. But the other element of it is that they just have a constituent amount of capable players now, which is so essential for any team, especially one whose stars aren't always the most reliable physically. I mean, that's just the point in LeBron's career that we're at, and that's been Anthony Davis' almost entire career. With Reeves and Vincent and Hachimura, and we'll see what Torian Prince can give them. Like, they have a lot of guys who aren't ever going to probably be the best player, other than maybe in, like, they get hot in a given game, but are capable filling out the rotation. And I wouldn't be surprised if they have one of LeBron and Davis healthy, if they'll just run through mid-tier and below teams. Like, I think they're actually better. I'm not saying bet they're over, because we don't know what that is yet, but I think that they'll be able to kind of, that's the threshold. Like, we used to talk about this with the Spurs, that if you can beat them, the 15th and worst teams consistently, you'll have a good record.
Market's out, by the way. It's 48.5 for the Lakers.
Ooh, that's high. That's higher than I wanted it to be.
Yeah, this is the problem.
The LeBron pricing.
The Lakers bump is very evident. I'm not low on the Lakers. So I have them very solidly in tier three. And if you told me they won the championship, would I be shocked? And it's like, oh, look, they do have LeBron James and Anthony Davis, and that's been a formula for a 50-win team, except for last year. I think I am a little confused by the conversation about them. And again, like, this matters for me in terms of reacting to the market. Mm-hmm. And so the idea has been, like, they've gotten A's across the board from everyone. What a fantastic offseason. And I've kind of tilted my head a little bit at it, where it's not that I think that they didn't have a good offseason. They certainly did. Retained Austin Reeves on an affordable contract. Great. Like, everyone knew that was going to happen, but I understand if there was, like, there was technically some question of, like, who was he going to be back? Retained, you know, Rui. Sure. I love the Rui addition. I thought that was the better trade for the two of them. Gabe Vincent, I'm a big guy. I'm a big believer in him. I thought he was one of the best free agents on the market because his market sucked, but it's also just like he was really good. And he, if he was the clear-cut starter, then I would probably, if you took D'Angelo Russell and you converted him into a forward or a center or two centers or a center and a forward or a center and a guard or any other combination that is not D'Angelo Russell, I'd probably feel a little bit better about this because I think Gabe Vincent would be a perfectly good starter next to LeBron James. Like, it fits absolutely the mold of the kind of guy that you would want to have next to LeBron, and he works well with AD too. Like, he'll probably help in those situations to have those two next to each other. But they kept D'Angelo Russell because they had to. And I just don't simply know if he's a positive addition overall. I don't know if he is a overall net positive in a regular season or playoff context. I don't know whether he's going to have a net positive or negative net rating next year with this team. And that variability, I think, is very tough. Like, if he is handcuffed to LeBron and Austin Reeves, then yeah, he's probably got a positive net rating because those guys are good and they'll bring you up. Will they be better without him? I think so. I think probably everybody will probably have a slightly better offensive ratings and overall net ratings when Russell's not on the floor, just because of the way that D'Angelo plays. And there are things I think D'Angelo brings to the table that are good. It's just like the way that they play, I don't necessarily love the idea of like, okay, we have this defense first, versatile, tough roster. Oh, also we have D'Angelo Russell. And I'm kind of like, oh, I don't know about that. Like, that feels a little Jordan Clarkson with the Jazz-ish. And the problem with that is that Jordan Clarkson was coming off the bench and not starting. And this wasn't your big starting third highest salary guy. Torian Prince, love him. Great player. Like, or not great player. Great locker room dude. Veteran. Knows how to play. Has battled to stay in this league. Absolutely fits what they want to do. He is a slight upgrade over the other guys that they moved on from. Like, I think that's an upgrade. Is Torian Prince like a needle mover for me? Not necessarily. Like, I've upgraded the Lakers from their like trying to figure out a rating on them, because I only have the way that my system is constructed, I only can really do full season. So I have to take like what their full season number was and then like completely extrapolate the end of the season run in the playoffs. I will also say that the post All-Star stuff, I have a little bit of a question about. Of just, March is a month that I do not trust in the NBA. The teams that are awesome in that run, I'm like, you're facing a bunch of teams that are either resting, exhausted, injured, or tanking. And so their dominance in that stretch, and you go like, well, they carry that into the playoffs. Sure, absolutely. The playoff run was also pretty contextual, where they faced a Memphis team that had the two injuries that I mentioned and was absolutely falling apart internally. And then they faced a Warriors team coming off of a 7-game series versus the Kings, and teams on after 7-game series, the records are incredibly terrible. And the Warriors were just like, they honestly at that point were not very good. And it's the Lakers did that to them, and they deserve credit for being the first team to beat the Warriors in the Western Conference playoffs. I'm just like not quite as high on them to put them tier two. I'm like, yeah, they could get there. They have more moves to make. If they find somebody to take Russell, this could get really interesting. But at every possibility of their improvement has to be couched with LeBron and how many games he will have to miss, and Anthony Davis and how many games he will have to miss. And we have longstanding histories of both of those guys to suggest we should probably be a little bit more conservative in their estimation of what those are going to be.
We absolutely should be. The team that we haven't discussed so far that I think is probably the juiciest would probably be the Phoenix Suns. I've had trouble. I would say maybe I've had less trouble than some tracking them. What's your read right now on Phoenix?
I think a lot of it is our lasting impression from them is what they did is how they looked in that second round, how helpless they looked versus the Nuggets. And I do think that a lot of this was how much of a matchup advantage that was. Internally, Denver was anxious to play Phoenix, which I thought was interesting given how they exited 2 years ago without Jamal Murray. They felt very confident in that matchup. And then you have the Chris Paul injury. And you have how bad the depth kind of revealed itself. I thought Monty got really outcoached. I think Frank Vogel is an upgrade. I just think he is. I think that's an upgrade. Kind of like the Lakers, where everyone raved about what the Suns did and just like had such a like, look at all these players that the Suns added. And I'm kind of like, I don't know, guys. I don't know that we should make a big deal out of Kate Diop and Drew Eubanks. I like those guys. I think that they can be rotation.
Here's the challenge. I really like what they did relative to the limitations they had, but that only matters so far.
So much.
You know, it's like, okay, you did well on minimums. Yeah, but your fifth most expensive player is making his minimum. That is a fundamentally different thing. And along those lines, the other big challenge for me with the Suns, and it's funny you brought up the Nuggets and everything else, is that my operating theory of NBA basketball in the playoffs for a long time has been, okay, well, you need to be elite on one end of the floor, and then you need to be at least good to very good, ideally elite, but that's too much to ask, on the other end of the floor. And we've seen, you talked about some of the interplay of whether that's high-end offense or high-end defense with winning. But my big concern, my concerns with the Suns are twofold. One, I think their offense is going to be very good, but is it going to be like top two good, or is it going to be like top 10, top five good? That's one question. But the bigger one is, I don't trust their defense. Like they can't, I don't think they can get to lineups that take enough away from other teams. And as much as, you know, like maybe Frank Vogel is going to help their defensive identity, like it's a lot to ask of this team to be able to pull it to top 10 other than with shooting line.
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit more bullish here. And the reason is when KD wants to, and KD usually wants to, like KD's been a pretty underrated defender the last couple of seasons. He can do pretty good work, especially in the regular season. He gives good effort. He knows how to defend. Obviously, the length is a thing, and he's stronger now because he's older. And so KD's gotten pretty good. Devin was legitimately good last year. Not like great, but the level of definitely not a liability. And I kind of put that in like he's like a little bit in the Steph tier of, you know what, effort goes a long way and you can make up for things with quick hands. And then you add in like his added length and athleticism, and you have a pretty good defender. Not great, just totally fine. I think Aiden has a lot of potential here, and we'll just see kind of what happens. That's like a big question mark for me, just because Aiden doesn't want to be there. He didn't want to be there 2 years ago, didn't want to be there last year, was unhappy the entire time, feuded with teammates, like pretty miserable. It's hard for a guy to be good when he's unhappy. Maybe Frank Vogel fixes all that. Like Mikal Bridges, who clearly had issues with him. We saw some of the fights on the sideline with him. He's gone, and Monty Williams is gone. That might fix it. Like there's a chance that this turns around and Aiden is able to put it together, because I think that when we look 2 years ago at the finals run, Aiden really was good defensively, and there's a lot that he can provide. Their versatility is a problem. I think that I really do criticize their roster construction from moving away from the versatility of 21, because they had a real ability in 21 to be able to throw a bunch of different looks at you, whether it was Dario Saric at the five or playing bigger ball with, you know, Jay Crowder at the four. They had a lot of versatility, and they kind of gotten away from that.
Yeah, it's not only the versatility, but it's also like a lot of the better players they have on the bench. Yuta Watanabe and Bates Diop are the notable exceptions here. A lot of them don't change the way you play. Like, I like Damian Lee. I like Eric Gordon. They don't really change the way you play on offense or defense. They're just good players, which is, I mean, that's great for the minimum. If you can get a capable basketball player for the minimum, you win. Like, that's a great thing. But this idea of, yeah, them being like amorphous and being able to try all these different things, like, that's just not the group they have. That means, like, the other big part of this to me is I love Kevin Durant as a help defender, but they don't have anybody to be the primary defender on those, you know, those wing guys. Now, there aren't as many teams that are wing centric. There aren't as many teams that are wing dominated as there used to be. There, you know, the West has a couple of them, including the Clippers, who we'll see what in the world they end up looking like. And to an extent, the Lakers, depending on how you define LeBron James here. But, and I mean, and then whoever makes it out of the East, should they get there, is probably going to have some good players that the Suns would have trouble handling. But the other kind of big question that I've had is, like, I agree with you on Ayton, like the idea that a better version of Ayton could be a good fit for the Suns, but a current version or worse version of Ayton is a real problem for them. Is I don't know how a reallocation trade happens, because it seems pretty clear that DeAndre Ayton was very available, at least in some form. And maybe it wasn't as much like the last 3 months after the Beal thing and everything else, but I don't, like, you know, the example could be like, well, what do you think about what the Lakers did with Russell Westbrook? Well, the similarity is that, like, Westbrook was a more flawed player then than Ayton is now, but Westbrook was an expiring contract, and the circumstances were favorable to make that happen. I'm not saying it's impossible. I do think that it's possible. But if the Suns need to make that reallocation deal, if you're trying to get a wing out of it, good luck. Like, they're very hard to get, especially when you have basically no first round things other than a few little swap rights still left. And B, they don't really have the stopgap center stuff. Like, oh, they're going to trade DeAndre Ayton for smaller players and what, get a buyout guy? Get, you know, like, they don't even have Jock Landale anymore. They probably aren't going to start the season with Bismack Biyombo. Like, they don't really have those, like, Bol Bol isn't that guy. He's a different guy. And I it's hard for me to figure them out.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's Drew Eubanks at 6'9", right? And so, I agree. I think that one of the things, though, is with them in the market, this is based off of conversations I've had, is he was the chip, right? One of the reasons that trade I don't think ever happened was they needed to move him because of his unhappiness and the awkwardness and everything else, but they were only going to move him in a star move, and the Nets ultimately didn't have any interest in him. They were like, no, we want McHale. Like, you're not getting this deal done without McHale. And so what you wind up with is you have this asset that you have to get great return on that everyone knows is a stressed asset, and that combination
Wizards didn't want him either.
Right. And then you've got, you know, also you've got, I think Dallas has just been difficult to try and convince to pull off a move for center. They have been very bearish in their approach to trades for centers, which is why the Capella deal hasn't happened yet. It's why, like, they want a center, but they don't want to pay much for him, is kind of the way. And so the limited suitors are kind of difficult there. And the centers, like, you know, the Mavs have centers to send back, which makes them an ideal trade target. But kind of getting that deal done, I think, was difficult. We kind of mentioned this just, I try not to, in this overall strength exercise, get into the, but what happens if they run up against Y in the playoffs? Because, like, yes. Look, you know, if they run up against Denver again, they don't have anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, what are you going to put? Is Booker going to have to shadow him? Jamal Murray the entire time? Probably not. Can you put Bradley Beal on him? I would not want to. Okay, so it's probably Josh Okogie again. How'd that work out last time, right? But if Denver's not there because of X, Y, or Z reasons, if they're there but not in their bracket, and somebody else knocks them off when they've got a favorable matchup,
sure,
then you don't have to worry about it. And so the overall team strength is, look, they still have, to me, honestly, Beal is – it's not negative. I'm not like shouting to the rooftops about how amazing this move is and how great they're going to be. But Devin and KD is a really awesome combo. It was awesome last year. It will be awesome this year. They were 12-1 in the regular season, or 12-1 in their first 13 games together. They were awesome to start with when those guys played together. Now Chris was part of that and he's gone. But Beal's probably an upgrade over Chris just because of age in terms of overall player strength. And then they have enough, and Vogel's probably enough to put them in this conversation where it's like, if everything clicked into place, then yeah, I think this is probably a title team.
One team we haven't discussed yet, who is actually maybe more firmly in my tier three than they might be for some, is the Sacramento Kings. And the way I wanted to describe it is this. I was, of course, lower on them throughout last season, and I'm thrilled with how well things went. And I believe that what they did last year is legit. I think that they were the number one offense. They were eighth in net rating at plus 2.4. I think, you know, they were extremely healthy, and you can't project that year to year. Though, I mean, Sabonis was injured and played through it for a significant portion of last year. Here's the thing, though. I went back and looked at this because I had a theory and it ended up being right. Plus 2.4 net rating. Very good. Good enough for eighth last year. That same clean the glass net rating would have been seventh in the Western Conference in 21-22. Yeah. And so even if there is an argument, I think there's an argument that the Kings will be a similar quality team. And even if you say they'll be less healthy, but maybe that they'll get some step-ups from some of these young guys, including Keegan Murray, who I really like, and some of these other, and, you know, like Fox, and just getting used to all the stuff that Mike Brown was doing, and, you know, getting players like Vezhenkov who make sense with what they want to do. The problem is that generally the West will be stronger than it was. And so I have them, the way my tier three is run, is it's teams that I expect to be in the top six, but not in a conference final. And again, that's not trying to factor in, oh, they'll be the two seed and they'll be the three seed and they'll play this two seed and they'll have a problem with it. It's just, there are certain teams, and I always think back to the Blazers as being an example of this. And yes, they did technically make a conference finals when the three best teams in the conference were on the other side of the bracket. But that kind of a team where they'll win a bunch of games, and I don't know what they'll do in the playoffs. And like, I think that some people will see that as a dig on the Kings. I don't see it that way at all. Like, to me, if they can be top six again this year, that'd be an accomplishment.
Yeah, I think trying to figure out regression, I think, is a tough one just to try and factor a lot of this into it. For me, this is a lot simpler. And here's a limited sample number that I think is at least interesting as a talking point. It's a very small sample, 13 teams. Top five offenses who were in the 40th percentile or lower in injury rate, man games lost in the last 10 seasons, have gone 9-4 to the under on their win total the following season.
Interesting.
So what we see here is if you were an extremely healthy team, which the Kings were, they were absurdly healthy last year. And the argument would be, I've heard Kings fans say, well, Sabonis was playing with his hand injury, or the guys were playing through various things. That's fair to a degree. Having a guy playing is better than him not playing. It just is. They were statistically one of the healthiest teams that we've seen
also
recently.
Other teams have guys that play hurt too. It was anomalous for them, right? But it is still.
So if you had an elite offense and you missed almost no games, or at least pretty healthy amount of no games, you tend to see a little bit of regression. And this factors the same way over just injuries. Teams in the 40th percentile or lower in injury rate the following season are 44-34 to the under the following season. So we do see a little bit of a move backwards for them. And that's a market indicated thing. So it's not always about team strength and whether they got worse. Like, you could be better than you were the previous season and still not hit your over on the win total. That's entirely possible. But what I do think is kind of evident here for me is just they did miss a window for they tried. I know that they tried from talking to people to aggressively pursue upgrades. They went after OG Anunoby. They went after Mikal Bridges. They went to the degree that you ever could have those conversations. They went after all of these guys to try and get a substantial upgrade on the wing. And all of those conversations fell short. They couldn't get any of them done. And so they just re-signed Harrison Barnes. And that's fine. And it's not that Barnes was bad last year. It was that they missed a window to be like, we're going to get a lot better. They have a lot of guys, I will say this, that can make jumps because so many of their guys are still young. And I'm not even talking about like the stars who are getting to be in their middle primes here with Fox and Sabonis. But you got Keegan Murray, who had a fantastic rookie season. He could be better next year. Maybe there's a sophomore slump, but maybe there's not. Maybe he's even better. You have the, like, Vezenkov, I think, is like a really interesting, like, thing to throw in there and just be like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what this looks like. Davion Mitchell, another one. Chris Duarte, who was really good. I talked to Tony East, who covers the Pacers really well, and was asking about, I was like, what the hell happened with Duarte? And he was basically like, he can't play fast. And their entire team identity is fast. Now, the Kings are not a slow team by any means, but they're not Indiana fast either. Well, with Sabonis.
And the point that Caitlin Cooper made, which is so good, is that the single NBA player that Chris Duarte has had the best individual chemistry with in his career is Domantas Sabonis.
Sabonis, right. And so you have these internal measures that can kind of improve, but just from a trying to recapture the magic of last season, that's a lot of this too, is it was like, it was so magical. Not only did they make the playoffs, they won the division. Like, all of these, like, it was such a dream season. They knocked, like, they almost knocked off the Warriors. They were in game seven versus Golden State. Like, they were right there. And that's such an amazing season, and everyone loved watching it, and they were really, that was really great. What happens next?
There's the parallel with the Hawks from a couple years ago of how do you handle disappointment? Because yes, they didn't make the conference finals like that Hawks team did, which is still so weird in hindsight, but the idea that they had this wonderful season, this is a young team, let's say they end up close to expectations, but below, individually, collectively, what does that mean? Are they just like, okay, we had a good season, like, we'll work forward, or do the guys like spin out a little bit just because they're like, oh, we thought we were going to be this good forever, we thought things were going to go well? And it's a very hard thing emotionally for players and a front office to take if that ends up happening.
And now, just to mention, from a market perspective, their win total is 43.5. Like, it's extremely low. So, like, the market is expecting, I think, too much regression here, to the point where I'm probably going to have a small play on the over. But if we talk about just the overall team, they've got to be, I think, in tier three here. My tier three is pretty fat here. I've got Sacramento. This is a shocker to me. I have Sacramento and Golden State in the same tier. Sacramento, Golden State, New Orleans, the Lakers, the Clippers, the Hawks, the Wolves, the Mavericks, the Sixers, if they get bad return on the James Harden deal. And the New York Knicks. And all of these teams to me are teams that I can see if they are just a little better in some unknown area, if there's one factor that we don't anticipate, that we can't anticipate, if the unknown unknowns work in their favor, then these teams can very easily be tier two and be championship contenders. And that includes the Sacramento Kings and the New York Knicks. Like, I think those teams can be in that conversation if they get the right set of circumstances and the right types of evolution and the right types of developments. If things go right for them, if the Kings are just healthy again, they can absolutely be in a softer side of a bracket and be in a position to make a run. The Knicks, I think, are a really interesting team. I'd love to get your thoughts on them as far as what to expect from them this season, because I'm just trying to grapple with, I've really started to weight towards offensive teams, so the Knicks have to be there. They were the second best offense in the second half of the season. I'm trying to understand, at least post All-Star, I'm trying to understand how to square that with a Tom Thibodeau team that was this good offensively. How good is Jalen Brunson? I'm curious as to know where you had New York.
I have them in this tier as well, I'm not as like excited about the possibility of moving them up. I think it's possible. I'm not going to foreclose on that possibility, but one thing that I've had trouble squaring with them too, you brought up a couple of them, is that the Knicks last year were second in offense despite being 20th in effective field goal percentage, which is the most important of the four factors, and like, that's just super duper weird. And so part of that, I think, is really real. So one is their offensive rebounding. Yeah. If you're going to tell me the Knicks are going to offensive rebound well with their personnel, like, I'll tell you, yeah, absolutely. That's not a problem at all. They've been top six three of the last 4 years. And turning the ball over, relatively low amount, that wouldn't surprise me either. I think that the addition of Jalen Brunson and everything else like that, I think that's very real. And then getting to the line, reasonable. And depending on who gets time and how they develop everything, I think that's fine. And I think that offensively, like, so number two might be that's rarefied. Like, I think that's probably a little bit too realistic, but I think they're a top 10 offense. Like, I think that they're top 10. It wouldn't stun me if they were more in the like fourth through eighth range. Maybe that's too much anchoring based on this year, considering how anomalous it was. But the other thing about the Knicks as an offense is that they have these flaws, but they're flaws that are hard for other teams to capitalize on in the regular season, in part because of their personnel and in part because teams don't do specific scouts. Like, that's just not generally the way that it works. So if I had to guess, I think that their offense will work reasonably well game to game. And even if the bottom of the league is stronger this year, which I believe that it will be compared to other years, they'll still have that. And then once the bottom falls out because some of these teams will stop trying, then I think they'll really start running roughshod through some of these teams. And like they're well constructed for that. The other thing that I really like about the Knicks, and this came into play for them, I think of it more in the middle, the kind of the middle third of the year, though it came in later too, is they might not have a lot of guys that I love in the closing five, but they have rotation quality basically at, you know, they're like 10 deep, and losing Toppin and a couple other guys is a little bit awkward there. But, you know, with Randall, Brunson, Barrett, Robinson, Hart, DiVincenzo, Hartenstein, Quickly, Grimes, and then hopefully you get some Deuce McBride or Jericho Sims working in there. Like, that's a lot of quality players. Yeah. And they have an identity. They've done well in that second unit. And so, like, I think of them as that, like, consistently good, but not particularly dangerous team, which, I mean, compared to where they were a couple of years ago, like, it's not a bad place to be.
I agree. I think that I'm really curious about the Toppin move, just because so many of the lineup combinations that worked, like the dirty secret last year was kind of that the starters were not great and they killed the bench. And I'm very curious to see, because they're banking that that's not going to happen this year, that they're going to get enough evolution from what they saw in the playoffs to carry forward. What are we getting from Julius Randle this year? Because every other year, it seems like we're getting something the exact opposite that we saw the previous season. You know, what are we going to get from Julius this year? I think is a really fascinating, bizarre question. I think I'm curious about what the bench looks like with Quickly without Toppin, but with Hartenstein. That's like an interesting kind of like combination to be like, maybe they'll just be good. Quentin Grimes was really good in the playoffs. Josh Hart's numbers are terrific. Like, they're just phenomenal in the Josh Hart minutes in the regular season, in limited time. So there's all these kind of ways for them to get there. The potential is there, but they're going to need a lot. They need a season where everything goes right. I don't think everything went right last season. I think they had a lot of things that didn't go right last season, and they still got to where they were. They still made the second round. So I'm curious to see what happens if they get a tail outcome in the positive sense for both injury luck and development. RJ Barrett's another one, like, I have questions about. So there's two guys in their starting unit that I'm like, what are we getting here? But at the same time, there's enough good there, I think, to have some belief that they're going to be there. Two of the teams in this tier, I think, that I have higher than probably most people have are Atlanta and Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Some of this is built off of Atlanta has at least the capacity, the potential to be able to pull off a Siakam trade if Toronto ever gives up the ghost. And that combo is extremely exciting to me. The idea of Trae Young.
You mean Trae and Siakam?
Trae Young, DeJounte Murray, and Siakam as a trio. I love that combo. I just think that there's a lot. DeJounte's numbers were poor last year, especially without Trae on the court. It didn't match eye tests, so I'm trying to understand why and trying to go back and do some more research on that. But a lot of this is very simply, I cannot overstress the coaching upgrade here, in that Quinn Snyder is so good in the regular season and is so good at maximizing talent and is so good at managing a roster in such a way that you do get developmental guys that get opportunities to show what they can do, and he identifies that and gives them the chance to succeed while also not letting that undermine or poison the best units that he will put out there. I think Trae probably has a bounce back season, and from if you look at his individual numbers, they don't make a lot of sense from a scoring perspective. All of these kind of combos, I think Atlanta's got a real capacity to get there. Similar kind of deal with Minnesota. They lost some guys, and that's not great. I love what they added, though, and I do think that a full year together, now that they're kind of past the shock of the Rudy Gobert trade and past the annoyance that they carried early in the season, like, people forget they won 42 games, made the play-in, had a lead on the Lakers for the final play for the first play-in spot for the seventh seed in the easier side of the bracket. They had all of that, and Kat missed almost the entire season. And no matter what you think about Karl Anthony Towns, from just a production standpoint, he helps immensely. And from a salary standpoint, when you're missing that much money on the court, you're going to be worse. And yet they managed, by the end of the year, they had a real identity as tough, veteran, professional group. And I think that they can carry that this year forward. I have a lot of belief in Chris Finch. I think Atlanta and Minnesota are probably a little bit slept on in terms of what their high-end outcomes can be.
I agree with you wholeheartedly on Minnesota, and the argument on Quinn Snyder is something I hadn't fully considered, and him getting a full season there, and especially getting an offseason and a preseason, will be massively important. I'm that 10 tempts me. And I mean, the other part of this to consider is that before the most recent season, the Hawks were ridiculous whenever Trae Young was on the floor offensively every single year. And they were very good. They just weren't, you know, ridiculous last year. And if you expect some of that other kind of flurry stuff to get better than non-Trae minutes, maybe that can improve in the future. But yeah, I agree with you on Minnesota. I think that they're not only do they have a clear starting and closing five, but they have underappreciated depth. And they got incredible work out of Kyle Anderson last year. But they're not going to necessarily need that. And then they have all these other guards
I think it's going to work. Clippers, kind of obvious here. They could definitely be there. I'm not going to put them in tier two just because last year I had such faith in their depth and it all failed miserably. A lot of capacity for a bounce back, but also a lot of capacity for another disappointing, like, why did you just run this back? What did you think was going to happen kind of moment? The Harden thing, that does not move me a lot. Like, yeah, it's great. Another star. Okay, cool. But we've seen kind of the inconsistency there.
Well, wait, one more thing on the Clippers. I think that it's so weird to compare the two for other reasons, but there's this idea that I brought up years ago with Clay. So he missed, had those two sequential injuries, and the idea that you can't predict that a player will be the guy multiple years later that they were when they were out, not only due to the injuries, but due to the recovery. So like Kawhi Leonard in the 21 playoffs before he got hurt was an absolute monster. An incredible player, and was had that awesome series, and then gets hurt in the Jazz, and then gets hurt in the Jazz series. It will be 3 years from when that occurred to when he plays in the playoffs again, if he is available to play in the playoffs again. I love Kawhi. I think that he, the guy who he was when he left us was the one of the few earthquake game changing guys in the league. I love Kawhi Leonard. I can't say for certain that guy is the guy who comes back because we just don't know.
What tier do you have Golden State in?
I actually have them tier two. I feel not great about that. I have them at the bottom of that group. I have the Clippers in tier two, and I think I might move both of them down to tier three. It kind of feels like, why am I, because it's a playoff thing versus a regular season thing, and it's like, I think I'm over-indexing to a healthy playoff run, so I'm going to move them down to tier three.
I don't know what to do with them, because it's like, do I think that Clay will be, you're so impacted by the playoff run, but even when if you remove the playoff run, you're left with the road record last season that was just so horrific, and that impacted, eventually you are what the record, and especially what the point differential says you are, which is they were a top 10 team, but they weren't any better than that. They were at the end of the top 10.
They were, and I think that the losing some of the guys they lost, the loss of variance, I think is generally actually more of a negative than some people think, but one small move that I think could make a big difference for them is Saric. Just having another capable front court player who can make good decisions, and I will be perpetually perplexed by how the Suns with Saric at center defended really well 2.5 years ago. Yeah. It was one of the weirdest things in the NBA for me. But he's a good basketball player, and a guy that Steve Kerr will trust enough to play. And that, so having him, but there, this is still a team that can't handle injuries to any of their good players. And you can say, now they have Chris Paul. Chris Paul is not Stephen Curry, and he hasn't been for a long time now.
Right.
But they have Gary Payton, who not only will be available on the team for more of the year, but also will presumably be healthier than he was last year. This is the put up or shut up year for both Kuminga and Moody. I think my theory of the Warriors is that their best is going to be as good as almost anyone. I think they're still going to have their fastball. It's just that I don't remember how into baseball you are, but it's kind of feels to me like what I remember late career Nolan Ryan being like, where he would have these moments where, I think he threw a no-hitter in his 40s, where it's like, oh crap, he can put it together, but it just wasn't every game. And I think that's going to be largely the story for them, unless some of those put up or shut up guys like Kuminga and Moody, all of a sudden they're not only clear cut reserves, they're heir apparent starters. If that happens, then they're tier two, potentially tier one.
I think one of the reasons I was almost tempted to put them in tier four was you're right, but you're only right about their best being the best when all the starters are on the floor.
Exactly.
And one of the problems is that the way that they used to be was the starters were untouchable. And that honestly infused the rest of the team with the ability to play not as well, but still incredible for units that didn't have all five starters on the court. And now it's like there's two universes. There's a team when Steph Curry's on the floor. And there is a below average sub 500 lottery team when he's not on the court. And they don't have, and the idea is that Chris is going to probably be able to raise that more than Jordan Poole was able to. And maybe minutes with Chris and Draymond absolutely click because of the combined basketball IQ and toughness of those two guys. But when you factor in injuries, I'm still really shaken by what Klay looked like to end last year. Now, that was exhaustion, I think, in large part. But yeah, there's just, to me, unless they get a Kuminga or in particular a Moody pop, yeah. I just get a lot of concerns about how fragile this team is and how it could be, because last year that was a big problem, was like they're all the number that Zach Lowe repeatedly mentioned, and Zach's obviously the best writer in the biz, but he kept mentioning, and I had talked about it too, the net rating when the starters were on the floor, which was best in the league. And then I looked up what their record was in those games, and it was 13-14.
Mm-hmm.
And that stunned me, where I was like, wait. So you have the you are untouchable, and you can't get over 500. That's how bad the non-starter minutes are. And that was when I was like, okay, there are real problems here. So I'm going to be really interested to see what it looks like.
Speaking of teams where I'm interested to see what it looks like, the New Orleans Pelicans, I had them in my tier three as well. And there are so many possibilities for them. And New Orleans, it's been this way for a couple of years now, where it's just like, what I didn't want was the status quo, but I still am excited to see what this team was, because it's just like, part of it for me is just I'm just done with Valanciunas on this team. Like, I don't particularly like that fit, just how he kind of meshes with everything else. But they have so much talent. And New Orleans, because of their draft assets and because of kind of the way that their salaries are structured, this is a team sort of like the Raptors were a couple of years ago, except that they have Zion, where I think that all of their players could be better. Like, if you reshuffled it and added a couple of different things, I think that this roster could sing even more than it does. But they haven't really, they've been good enough that they haven't wanted to shake things up, and they've been kind of waiting to see how everything worked out. But like, this is a phenomenally talented group.
They are. They were number one in the West before things went haywire. I really wish that they had pulled the trigger and been able to figure out a way to get the two pick. I really wish that they had thrown in Ingram and various assets to get the two.
There are a few negotiations that I would like to know how they went, like each offer and counteroffer more than the Pelicans and the second and third picks. Like, yeah. just could they have gotten it done with Ingram? If they could have gotten it done with Ingram, I mean, I love Scoot Henderson. Like, I think people know that by now. Like, that would have been awesome.
It would have been incredible. And maybe it wouldn't have been as good in like the near term, but it would have been so much better for their upside long term. If they get everybody healthy back, that bench unit was so good. And again,
another team that has just like a billion quality NBA rotation players.
Yeah. Trey Murphy, I think, is underrated in terms of what he looks like as far as an impact guy. Jose Alvarado, those bench units with him and Larry Nance alongside Zion were killer. How different is this if you're just able to be like, Zion Williamson plays 66 games in the 2023-24 season? Then you're just like, okay, my next question would be like, okay, how many does Jose Alvarado play? How many does, like, I need to know the rest. Like, I do. I can't just do it.
What is Herb Jones' percentage from three?
Yeah, from three. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of things that have to go, but boy, that December moment was so special, and you thought that they were really like, wow, this team could do some things, and then it just fell apart. And I guess we'll kind of see.
By the way, is there a single number, like, if you could get a note from the future, a single number that would change the way you bet on over unders more than Stephen Curry's games played?
Oh yeah. Oh,
like that, I think that's the single biggest one in the entire league. If you could pick a single thing,
our favorite bet every year is Steph to lead the league in 3-pointers and pointers per game. If you miss the qualifying number, they take your total and divide it by the qualifying number, and he just squeaked ahead this year with the number of games. We were very concerned, but that one cashed for us. But yeah, there's like that one and the Warriors overrun. Like, there's so many markets that are impacted by just if you told me like Steph plays 70 versus Steph plays 40. The difference is absolutely massive. My tier four, and these are teams that I wish I could put in a higher tier, but I can't. But they are definably like, I think these are going to be, I would define this tier as troublemakers. OKC.
Yes.
The Utah Jazz. The Indiana Pacers, who I am incredibly bullish on, was soft bullish on them last year, am raging bullish on them now. The Orlando Magic, and it's kind of a throw in here because I don't think they belong lower, the Chicago Bulls. The Bulls are not one that I'm like, they could be real troublemakers. They're just like, no, they're better than the teams in my tier five, but I can't put them any higher, so they go here. They're honestly kind of more in their own tier by themselves. But OKC, I'm really fascinated in Utah because when I look at the roster, I simultaneously am like, this team could be really good again. And then I also go, this team's really young. And those two combos, I think, are with Will Hardy as coach, who I'm very high on, try to figure out an accurate ceiling floor for Utah, I think is a fascinating exercise.
I am intrigued by Utah's future. However, something that really lingers with me, I actually pulled the stats on this because I wanted to. After the All-Star break, 25th in offensive rating, negative 3.8 net rating, 8 and 14. The challenge is I like to use the term, I think I might have even originally gotten this from you, of organization. And that losing Mike Conley just took that organization away from their offense. And it also took away, you know, one of their best creators and all that. And what they've done since then, they've added a lot of good players, but they've never really brought in another organizer. And so my instinct on what happens with the Jazz is like, the whole is weaker than the sum of their parts for exactly one more year. They figure that out, they get that guy, and they're good. Like, really good.
I can see it. I take a lot of the stuff that we have here with their late season performance, I take it with a pretty big grain of salt.
Sure,
based
sure.
off of like, they were a team that definitively pivoted to be like, we don't want this.
They pivoted to video in a sense.
Yeah, like the Mavericks fans are very much in the idea of like defending their team's cowardly ass decision making with trying to say like, but look at what the Jazz and the Blazers did. And I'm like, I'm not any happier with the Jazz and the Blazers. They just weren't as close as you were. Like Utah, I think, could have made the playoffs. They could have pushed for that. And they just decided like, no, this is not worth it to us. And they basically did an about face. The numbers of the marketing were still really good. And I kind of, a lot of this is built off of,
yes.
You know, how good do you think Lauri Markkanen is? And one of the things that I've learned with Jokic, and I'm not suggesting that he's Jokic, but I am saying when a lot of the numbers tell you a guy is extremely impactful, you should probably believe them. Like, you should probably consider that there's something there. And Markkanen was 96th percentile in EPM last year. So you kind of have just like, look, they have one guy who is so good that it's going to raise that floor quite a bit for them. I tweeted this the other day. I couldn't believe. Have you seen Colin Sexton's splits?
With and without Markkanen?
No, just his shooting splits.
No.
So last season, Colin Sexton, he played 48 games. Okay. He averaged 14 points, 2 boards, 3 assists. Sure. 51% from the field, 39% from three, 82% from the line. So 51, 39, 82. Limited attempts for sure on a high function offense. I get it. And it's not that I'm expecting a huge, massive explosion for Sexton. But I was just kind of like, that's really interesting to me that you do have this evolution here of what this could look like, that they kind of kept apart last year for a number of reasons, and injury was part of it, and Mike Conley's like trade as essentially exhibition was part of it as well. But there's like all of these types of things that I think are interesting to kind of look at as far as like what they could be. And maybe they're not, but they have to be, I think, in this tier. Where do you have OKC, may I ask?
I'm here. I think this is a great, and I, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if by the midseason or something, I have them in tier three. Like, that, I believe a lot in this group. I think that Daigneault is a great coach. They exceeded every reasonable expectation defensively and should have better defensive personnel this year. And another thing I was thinking about with the Thunder, I was going through, I've been watching Summer League film because I didn't get to go as much in person this year. And I was thinking about how much I like their 21 draft relative, or sorry, I guess that'd be their 22 draft relative to how other teams fared. And generally speaking, this would be the year, though with Chet it gets complicated, that really starts to matter. You could talk about, oh, you know, Jalen Williams, the wing, he was a better rookie than most, which I had him second in my rookie of the year. But the year one to year two jump, especially for guys who are actually good, is massive. And so where Chet Holmgren fits into that is complicated because he missed functionally all of last year. So I think they're going to have more options. The other possibility that I've been fixated on with OKC is they have a ton of resources, and at some point they're going to have to use them, not just to draft picks, but to combine them to get good players. And if they're pushing strong this year, like, that time might be now.
I've been holding off on making some more bullish bets on them based off of a lot of my thought process is it's not dissimilar to the Clippers. The Clippers had a lot of veteran guys where I was like, oh, those guys are all really good. And the Thunder have a lot of young guys where I'm like, oh, those guys could all be really good.
I mean, they have like 17 NBA quality players on their roster right now.
Yeah. And that's why, like, you know, there's been already reports of it of people are there will be vultures circling when the OKC gets to camp and has to make cuts. And so a lot of this is also just like Shea, right? And OKC is different. What I think is interesting about this group is Chicago doesn't have this. Again, they're kind of in their own. I might just put them in a tier below. But like Markkanen, Halliburton, Banchero, and honestly, like for me with Orlando, it's less of Banchero as it is Banchero Wagner. Like, sure. it's that combo. It's those two guys.
Having a calling card, having somebody that a tone setter, that type of stuff.
And then there's Shea, who's like definitively above all of those guys. And like honestly, you start going through Shea Gilgeous-Alexander based off of his performance last season. How many guys in that tier above is would he be the best player on? He'd be the best player on New York. He'd be the best player on Sacramento. He would not be the best player on Golden State. He would be the best player on New Orleans, even with Zion. He would not be the best player on the Lakers, I think. Maybe, like, that's an interesting one with where LeBron and Iggy are at.
He'd be the best guy in the Wolves too.
He'd be the best guy on the Wolves. He'd be the best guy on the Hawks. Wouldn't be the best guy on the Clippers fully healthy. Wouldn't be the best guy on the Mavericks fully healthy. Although the gap between him and Luka is probably smaller than it is between Luka and most players in the league. And he would not be the best player on the Sixers, but boy, would I be a lot higher on them if it was you had Shea Gilgeous-Alexander as a number two instead of James Harden, and if you had Shea Gilgeous-Alexander able to be the number one in a playoff series. So it's like, when you have the guy that I'm that high on, they got to be at least in this tier.
Andrew, well coached.
Yeah, and they're extremely well coached. The path for them to accelerate is what I think is going to be interesting. Like, how does Presti manage this? Like, what's this timeline? You know, what's he aiming for? I think that's a really interesting question to ask. We're long, so I want to go ahead and keep going here.
Sure.
My one, two, three, four, my fifth tier, three teams. And I'll actually make this the sixth tier because I'm going to put Chicago and one above it. Toronto, Brooklyn, and Charlotte. And this is Brooklyn, I think, has a capacity to be a four tier. I think they could probably be a four tier team if things snapped exactly right for them. And if they made a really good Dorian Finney-Smith trade, I think that they're like Nick Claxton was a defensive player of the year candidate last year. He was a serious defensive monster. The production isn't there to put him in any sort of like serious conversation for impactful guys because he just doesn't do enough. But Mikhail showed a ton. Cam Johnson's numbers are absurd. Like, they are ridiculous. Go take a look at Cam Johnson's numbers last year, both with the Suns and especially with the Nets. They got a lot of options for depth. I like the guys that they added. I actually think they got some internal improvement. I think Brooklyn's got some upside here. Toronto's like passing them, right? Like, Toronto's on the way down, Brooklyn's on the way up. I will believe that the Raptors are giving up and trading guys when they do it. I can't believe it anymore. I'm refuse to get involved in these conversations for OG or Pascal. I'm not high on Scottie Barnes relative to especially how the Raptors view him. Losing FAV was a pretty big disaster for them given what they offered. And then there's Charlotte, who I don't want to put here. I want to put Charlotte in my last tier with San Antonio, Houston, Detroit, Portland, and Washington, but I can't because everybody, like, this is one where everybody else is like, no, like, Charlotte could be okay this year. I don't see it. I don't understand it. I have no idea what people are seeing, but I'm willing to be like, I'm not smart enough to see this. I'll put them here out of respect for the public consensus.
Well, here, I can give you the basic argument. Charlotte had a positive net rating in 21-22.
It's good.
I mean, like, and I mean, what in the world are we going to get from Miles Bridges? Who knows there? But, like, and they're, I think Clifford is a totally, totally credible NBA coach. They're presumably going to be, at some point, better owned and better run, though that might not be until 24, depending on how all this shakes out. It can take some time for these ownership groups. Like, do they have a new general manager by the deadline? I wish they had a new front office before the draft, but that's just me. I wonder about all those things. But the Hornets, like, I think that it's tempting, and there seems like this every year, where the relatively good times were so long ago that we forget that they happened. But, like, they were a completely credible team 2 years ago. They didn't make the playoffs anyway because they're a disaster in the play-in. But, like, there is a theory of the case, and they are a young team. Like, so I have them, and I call it dregs adjacent. And I have them there, and I have the Rockets there too, on the idea that, you know, it's a very different concept, but the idea of organization for them, like having Van Vliet, having, even though I don't love Dylan Brooks, I wish if they had gotten Brooke, I would have them, I don't even know how high I would have had them. But the idea that not only do you move other guys down in the pecking order, but you make life easier, and they also upgraded a lot at coach. Ime Udoka has his flaws, it appears, but he is also a very good basketball coach if he can narrow his focus to that. So, like, it wouldn't stun me if Houston made the play-in. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't have it over 50%. I do think there's a path.
I can't get there. I was ready to be a little more bullish on Houston, and I think I am bullish on. I think that my take on them is they're going to be better than the record. Their record's still going to be awful.
Mm-hmm. They might benefit from the West being strong again, where they, like, if they can get. Oh no, that's right. They only have their pick if it's top four, right?
That's right.
So then, yeah, I was going to say they benefit, but no, OKC probably benefits.
Yeah. 31 and a half over under for Houston, and this was like a very stark thing, is like, do you want to bet them to go over 32? And it's like,
that's gross.
I don't want to do that. And so then you're like, well, if you're betting the under, then you're probably saying that they're in the 20s. And if they're in the 20s, how bad are they? And you're like, well, they're pretty bad.
And the gravity pulls in one direction for teams. If you're not sure about an over 32 bet, then generally teams get dragged down together.
Yeah. And it's just like, I think I love the moves. I really do. Like, I love adding Fred VanVleet. This is part of the problem is, and Houston fans hate me for this. Like, I'm high on them and they still find a way to be upset with me. The lineup of Fred VanVleet, Amen Thompson, Jabari Smith Jr., Alperen Şengün, and whoever, like Jayshon Tate, whoever you want to fill in. If you want to play, you know, Şengün at four and Landale at five, those combos I'm really interested in. Like, the four-man lineup of VanVleet. Oh, it's gonna be Dylan Brooks is who's gonna be the three in that spot. But the four-man combo of VanVleet, Thompson, Şengün, and Smith, I'm very in. I am extremely in on that combo. And then you add in Jalen Green, and I'm like, oh, I don't like it as much.
Who might be a really good fifth in some of those?
Who?
KPJ. I've had this long running theory that Kevin Porter Jr., he's an off guard in both offense and defense, and now they have Amen Thompson and Fred VanVleet who can actually slide him over.
Yes. He's elite as a spot up shooter. So we'll see kind of like what this looks like. I'll be very interested to see what the offensive splits look like. I'm with you on Udoka is going to make them look like a professional basketball team. And that goes a long way towards you being competent. Like, just looking like you know what you're doing, that goes a long way in wins and losses. You will pick up, the margins will be slimmer. Nights when teams are having a bad night and not motivated and banged up and just tired, you will catch them more often if you are an organized basketball squad with actual NBA talent. So there's all of this capacity. I still have questions about shot selection. I still have questions about the front court depth. The defense should probably be a little bit worse. a lot of this is just how much can you reasonably expect an improvement, because they were so bad last year. As a marker, you know, I raised them a full 4 points in my power rating, which that's a huge move. That's a monstrous move. And that only gets me to 28 wins. Mm-hmm. If I move them six, if I give them essentially the impact, if we say that Fred VanVleet, Dylan Brooks, Jock Landale, the other guys that like the maturation, internal improvement, and Ime Udoka are worth the value of adding a Nikola Jokic, which is 6 points to this team, I still only get them to 32.9. That's as high as I can get them in wins. And so that's the gap that we're starting from. Like, if you take out the tanking and everything else and you move them six full points, you only get to a 33 win team, which is an over. But that's like if everything were to go right, and I cannot get there. So they're going to have to stay pretty low. I think that this is the year to still be bearish on Houston and be ready for next season to be very bullish on them.
That's fair. Anything else? I mean, I think the bottom teams are kind of the bottom teams. We'll end up talking about them a lot over the course of
Washington and Detroit are going to be as bad as I think, right? Like, there's no reason.
For Detroit, like, their overall talent level is actually better than I think some think, but they're not going to be able to put that into practice because their lineups are also weird. Yeah. If Monty Williams can, like, get... It's so funny that I'm arguing for a coach to have more of a voice in personnel, but if he could have more of a voice there and they can get some lineups out there that have actual shooting, like, that would be pretty exciting.
Yeah. And then Washington, I just think it's...
Washington will be a fun bad team, but they will be a bad team.
Yeah, they lost too many guys that are...
And the Spurs, I think, so there's a theory that they will be better. Like, basically, they have a lot of guys that I like, Keldon Johnson, Vassell, obviously Wemby, and they have these functional vets. I just don't think they're going to have the pressure. Like, I don't think they're going to pressure themselves to be that team. And then they can just move some of those guys out for parts, and they take this year, get a pick, and then they push for next year. Sort of like you were talking about the Rockets.
I do like that overall, and when I did this exercise, I essentially have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and the Sixers, if they get good return, I have 8 teams that could win the title next season. And that's kind of what I want to see.
And there are so few bad teams too. Like, that's the, which is not only exciting, but also an argument that the NBA should expand because.
Yeah. I also think this is probably, again, I think this is, we're in preseason. And so it's like weighted up. Sure. And some of these teams we will just like absolutely be squashing into this. I've gotten by grade. So into the C's and the D's. The C and D tier will get a lot fatter. I think in the top will get a lot thinner as we go along.
Well, this has been an absolute delight. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Matt Moore for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work at the Action Network. You can listen to his excellent work, not only on the Action Network, but also Locked On NBA and Locked On Nuggets. And I truly love having him on. And thinking about the league in terms of team strength right now is not something I always do. This is more of an off-season, I don't think, full league, you know, do the division capsule pods, which hopefully are coming soon. So I love that Matt wanted to do this and that we put it together, and I really enjoyed the process of it, as I always do with him. If you want to support the show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode, really whatever podcast player you use. And if you want this on a podcast player that it does not exist on, please let me know, and I can pass that to people who know how to fix that. It's not me. You can also help the show by helping other people find Real GM Radio. That can be leaving a rating and review. That can be social media, word of mouth. Really do appreciate it. And the most important thing you can do for this podcast and any other that has them is to check out our sponsors. For us, that is FanDuel. FanDuel.com/Boston, and you get up to $200 in bonus bets, win or lose, which is awesome. And you can also check out my other work, Dunked On, Dunked On Prime, still going strong. We produce a ton of basketball content in the offseason. I was watching Summer League film this morning in preparation for our next Summer League episode, which will be coming out soon. And then we have offseason grades, and then Nate will do the detailed team-by-team recordings with experts on those specific subject matters. Then I should have some written work at The Athletic. Now that offseason is toning down, I actually have some time to think about and bring together some of these pieces. I have some ideas that I'm in process on. Thankfully, editorial has been patient with me. And if you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DanielLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. I don't promise to reply, though I intend to most of the time. But that is all for now. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.